Hi, I'm Iso Kent. I'm the founder of Athenian, and I've been working with engineering leaders for over a decade. You're about to listen to the first episode of Developing Leadership, a podcast that will feature Jason Warner, the CTO of GitHub, as my co-host. Jason and I will be chatting about the biggest lessons we've learned on engineering leadership throughout the years, in this episode and the ones to follow. So without further ado, here's the first episode of Developing Leadership. This is the first episode of Developing Leadership. I'm here with my co-host, Jason. Jason, let's maybe kick off and tell the world who you are.
Great. Everybody, I'm Jason Warner. I'm the CTO of GitHub. And before GitHub, I was the VP of engineering at Heroku. And then before Heroku, I was the VP of engineering and the head of engineering for Canonical. People make Ubuntu Linux. So who I am is probably better known as an engineering leader who cares about developers and then scaling organizations.
I'm really looking forward to Jason being my co-host here, because when we talk about Canonical, Ubuntu, Heroku, and GitHub, we actually talk about three of the pieces of technology that have actually shaped the way how we work and how engineering leadership has developed over time as well. And so to share a little bit about myself, I'm Iso Kent. I'm the co-founder and CEO of Athenian, where we focus on bringing data insights to engineering leaders. And I spend most of my time talking to engineering leaders. And having met hundreds and hundreds of engineering leaders over the last years, Jason is by far one of my favorites. So I feel very privileged and very lucky to call my co-host here. The idea for today that Jason and I had was to talk a little bit about how has engineering leadership and engineering organizations changed over time. And since you have a couple of years on me, Jason, I'd love for you to go back to the beginning of your career and what was it like back then? And let's try to kind of get maybe in this episode all the way up to the current days.
Sure. So back when megalodons kind of swam the seas type of deal.
Exactly. But we were all still using Subversion and Mercurial.
I started my career in the 90s, the mid 90s. I graduated high school and I was a co-op at IBM and went to school, computer science, all that sort of stuff, and just worked my way through the 2000s and then, the 2010s and everything like that. And I have to say leadership in general, the expectation of it has changed tremendously. Let me give you a story about what it was like way back when. I remember when I sat down at IBM after I graduated from college, very first time I got my paycheck, and I'm just trying to make heads or tails of this. Just like, I'm like a 21-year-old kid who's getting a paycheck for the first time from a large institution. I'm trying to figure out what was going to who and all that sort of stuff. And I see a cost center on there. So I go to ask somebody, like, well, what does the cost center mean? Well, it just means where you are in the organization, how IBM thinks about you and bills you. And so I dug in a little bit and figured out that in the cost center, they viewed me as an expense to the organization. I, as an engineer, was not essentially value creative. I was an expense that it took to run the business, but their business was actually sales. If you went over to the sales organization, that was very different to code on their paychecks. And I remember thinking to myself, like a little head scratchy, like, wait a second, wait, what does sales sell if I'm not here building a thing with all the other thousands of engineers? And are all thousand engineers or thousands of engineers also coded in the same way? And it turns out they were coded as a cost center expense. And it just kind of struck me as like this really backwards, antiquated way of thinking, but that was true. And I think that it showed up in how people thought about engineering leadership too. Another way to put this too, way back in the day, engineering leaders had struggled to get to the highest level of an organization. Many times, VPs of engineering or CTOs did not report to CEOs. They reported to CIOs or COOs or presidents or other things. And many times, even at startups, the head of engineering was not on the E staff, essentially, the executive staff. Now, 2021 would be unheard of to think about that. But way back when, it was a thing. In fact, if you think about 2021, if you have to list the second most important executive in most organizations, particularly pre-C stage, it's the CTO. And it's because that's where everything is getting done in the organization. Not everything, It's not everything getting done. It's like, hey, we need to actually build this thing and prove that it should exist in the market. And yeah, we got to go sell it and stuff too, but we actually have to have something to sell.
So you said something really interesting, which is, I sat there scratching my head like this didn't make sense. And I feel if we look back over time, a lot of the things that we kind of will unpack on are things that don't make sense to any 21-year-old who doesn't have a lot of knowledge yet, right? Like, what do you believe was really the return to common sense? And do you think we already have returned fully to common sense, or there's still a lot of things today that you're still scratching your head over?
You know, I think if I were to guess about the return to common sense, I would say that actually we're still probably midway through it, to be honest. Startups are likely operating differently than very large late-stage companies or public companies or laggard industry companies. Another good example of this would be, many people won't actually remember this, they probably started the career much after, but in the early 2000s, there was a massive, massive offshoring trend. Almost every large organization in the world was offshoring or nearshoring or whatever word they wanted to use for this. And it was considered fiscally irresponsible to not do it. And it was almost exclusively support folks and engineers. You know, that had cataclysmically bad outcomes for a lot of organizations. And it had nothing to do with the people that they were hiring. It had to do with how they thought of what they were doing. They thought that they can go get lower skill, cheaper labor, and other organizations had the same output. And the real thing that they were thinking here is, again, cost center sort of thinking. And then what they realized was that the value creation inside their organizations were in the engineering, so that they started still offshoring, but paying better and getting higher, more experienced talent, having better outcomes. And then they realized, well, the way that we're doing this is wrong too. And some of them changed early, and some of them are still trying to dig themselves out of that hole.
It's funny you say that. Most people actually don't know this about me, but when I took my very first stab at, back then it wasn't called startups even yet in Europe, we called them internet projects. I had built something that was actually making money and it needed to scale up. And I was exactly caught in that world. Everyone's like, you need to outsource. That's what everybody is doing. This was like in the early 2000s. And so I got a team in Pune, India. And I very quickly realized that there was this mismatch. And like you said, it wasn't about the people. It was about the mentality of this mentality of like, hey, these are people who are just there to produce lines of code, and that's going to somehow actually bring you to value. So what you're saying is, you know, we've gone through this transition of, you know, you can no longer see engineering as a cost center because, well, software is now so obvious in our business and success for our business that we can't ignore anymore the people who are building it, at least gladly in many companies, like you said, not yet all. But between that kind of Mark Andreessen saying, you know, software is eating the world, and that coming true, which kind of happened around, you know, post-financial crisis, 2008, if I'm remembering correctly. And then this time in the mid-90s, still a lot changed, right? You lived through this first bubble of tech companies' valuations and then kind of the crash after. This kind of period of the mid-90s to 2008, what really changed there in the mindset of engineering leadership?
I still think that even up to 2008, it was likely considered, you know, engineering leadership was not real leadership. Engineering leadership was spreadsheet jockeying, getting stuff done, all of that. You know, the whole idea of communication and organization and all that sort of stuff, like the height of that was Agile at the time. And Agile was, again, I think more of a symptom of anything. Like we were kind of toying with Agile and XP and a bunch of other things that really ultimately panned out to be just tools in the end. And while sales folks had been building methodologies for many years in terms of, like, you know, TAS or Challenger method or whatever, all these different playbooks, engineering was still not quite there. Now, I think that a couple of things happened at the same time. One is open source just exploded in the late 90s into the early 2000s. And I think that, one, engineers' expectations changed. When engineers themselves could work in the open with open source with other engineers, and they can kind of self-organize to a degree and get stuff done. And then they go to work and they have a dramatically 180-degree experience from that. They're like, well, hang on a second. Like, and that happened everywhere. All levels of the organization have engineers in it to a degree. And, like, you can see it. You know, I was a mid-level engineer at that point, but, you know, I was involved in open source and can even see my boss who was talking about some open source projects. I think that's one. I think the other is that we did have some tool expansion at the same time. We went, you know, from really terrible, like, just to be really blunt, like, Microsoft-based tools in the mid-90s. They were not very good for developers. They were locked in, full stack, no choice. And to the point where in 2005, I think it was, Rails was released in the beta format. And if you think about just a 10-year period from 1995 to 2005, where Rails was the culmination from a framework and language perspective to 1995, when you're using whatever version of Microsoft stuff at the time, it wasn't called .NET back then. I can't remember what it was called. You're essentially mainframing on the PC with Microsoft stuff, or you're cobbling together your own hardware and servers to do open source stuff all the way to Rails in a 10-year period. That, I think, changed a lot in a very short amount of time. And I personally believe that Rails did more for this from a tooling perspective to the zeitgeist of like what's possible what from a developer experience and tools.
So it's interesting you mentioned that, because when I was very young at the time, I've always had the feeling that what got the engineers passionate and excited over time and what drove these changes was the ability to finally get stuff done and see the result of your work faster, mm-hmm. right? Open source, all of a sudden, you know, you were at home and you were getting things done and you could see the result.
At night, on the weekends.
You didn't have to wait, you know, to like go through terrible processes or something that would finally land on the mainframe a lot longer. And Rails, right, with this underlying beautiful kind of aesthetic of Ruby at the time, all of a sudden said like, hey, you know, you can get things done a lot quicker now and in a way that feels a lot more elegant. And it almost feels like, you know, throughout, and I think we're still there, and I have some opinions on how we're in what direction we're going today, but I think almost, and I don't say this because you were at Heroku, but I almost feel like Heroku was like our peak efficiency point in time, where we really got to this moment of, you know, the 90s, where we were stuck working in ways that no one liked, open source showing us a better path ahead. All of a sudden, we get to this world of Rails where it's like, hey, I can build things and I can see the result of them. But now I still need to get them to people.
Yeah.
And I think, and so I'm curious, because you lived throughout that very viscerally and part of the tooling.
This is strong opinion territory all of a sudden.
Of course.
I would say this. I think Heroku plus GitHub in a magical moment was, like you said, peak efficiency. If you did Rails, Heroku, and GitHub, you had the best experience on the planet for developing software for a 4, 5, 6 year period in all likelihood. Then I think a couple of things happened and we're getting worse and we're trending worse. In my opinion. So I think one, I think the front end got a lot more complex. And I don't think our tooling kept up with some of the complexity and sprawl. And I think that we went into, I don't know if you want to call it the framework wars, but it felt like we just had to build new frameworks for everything. My joke with the JavaScript community is that they basically recreated Java. They've got their own Maven. They've got their own Ant. They've got their own Build. They got their own whatever. They basically recreated the entire Java world. And the worst developer experience I personally have ever had and worst professional experience is working on J2EE when you needed 5 books on your desk to do the flywheel pattern married with the factory bean method importer DAO factory, REPL, something. I don't know. But it was literally one of the worst experiences of my life and almost made me want to quit tech. And I feel like we're back at that in the JavaScript world, which means that we're due for a pendulum swing back to easier to use tools on that side of the fence as well, because that always happens. You do go through pendulum swings there. And now let's fast forward to what will be the next phase of development too. Not to get into like any sort of quote unquote religious territory, but crypto will be a big thing. Like protocol crypto is obviously a big thing. Let's not talk about coins, but protocol crypto is interesting. And the tools there are atrocious. And it literally is like working in bits and bytes again.
Yeah.
And it's dark magic. And so we are back in the 90s with those tools. And so we'll have to find those again as well.
So it's interesting you say this, because it's funny how we keep drifting back to tools while talking about leadership, but it's so intrinsically linked with the way that we work and the way that we collaborate, right? You touched upon earlier, right, Agile. I just went and looked up like the Agile Manifesto date. And I never realized it was called the Agile Software Development Manifesto.
Yep.
Came out February 11th in 2001. So we're 20 years later. And
open source is 30 years old. Agile is 20 years old. Scrum, I think, is 15 years old or something like that.
And so we've had these, I like this notion of pendulum shifts, because I think this, I couldn't agree more with you. This happens. I don't think it just happens in our tooling. It happens in our management practice. It happens in so many things. A lot of the way that we work today right? And let's take Agile as the foundation, because I think Agile with Scrum and Kanban stemming off from it is pretty much the foundation for most software organizations around the world, is 20 years old. And while it has developed to some extent, I'm pretty sure if you and I open up a book about Scrum or Kanban from 15 years ago, it's not going to read very differently from today. What is your viewpoint on kind of the pre-Agile world? And I agree, Agile was like a symptom of this massive amount of frustration to this kind of golden period of, hey, we think we found the solution, to where we are now almost 20 years later.
I'll flip it around a little bit and talk about startups for a second, because I think that startups actually are a good proxy for some of this too. We've had this conversation, you and I, in the past about scale and how scale changes everything from a technical perspective, yes, but from an organizational perspective too. So, you know, you're a single founder, you're working on everything. You don't have to write a single thing down. It's all in your head. You just keep going, going, going. You're two people in a garage with a dog. Like, what are you writing down? Well, it's mostly on a whiteboard in all likelihood. And now there's this moment, you know, where I think any successful founder or early team is talking about the good old days, and usually talking about sub 25 or probably very specifically sub 15 or 10 people, where they're just all in the same room, kind of working on stuff. And there's this kind of romanticization of the past there. What they're really talking about, from experience talking to some of these founders and also myself being there, is that it was just easier to get stuff done. You didn't have to worry about X, Ys, or Zs. And X, Ys, or Zs could be HR processes or compliance or release practices. It was just kind of like, I don't know, not to swear on a podcast, but get shit done, essentially. Yeah. And now you're 2,000 people and you're having to worry about engineering levels and whether or not you add a new one here in midway through, or you add another one at the top end. What that does is for the ranges, and you're having conversations you never thought you'd have, even if you were successful. Well, I kind of think from a proxy perspective, that's similar to the processes and what kind of happens. You just end up in a spot, in my opinion. Now, like stepping back, I think like from an Agile perspective, rational RUP and all that other stuff, if anyone remembers those things, those were tops-down kind of waterfall-y mega plan, Accenture, Deloitte style type of stuff, where engineers were effectively commoditized and everyone hated it and the results were atrocious. And we had a 20-year period where like incredible GDP destruction was done in that process. Agile is an approach that says, well, we'll go all the way from the top all the way to the bottom and try to do all this stuff organically from that perspective. And that to me is that pendulum swing. You go all the way from the top all the way to the bottom. And we had dramatically differently bad results from Agile all the way up from the bottom, because that's not how you do planning at scale. You cannot do all tops down and you cannot do all bottoms up planning. But the natural reaction is when you see something all the way on a pendulum is to go all the way to the other side of the pendulum instead of starting to understand what is actually happening.
So you mentioned, and I couldn't agree more. It's actually a shame because we could have an interesting discussion if I disagreed, but I definitely agree with you that we're on the pendulum shift of the JavaScript and front-end world and not just, I believe the same on infrastructure world, on a very extreme. If we look at a pendulum for, let's call it practices, right? Agile processes.
Yeah.
Where are we today?
So I think that we're shifting back from quote unquote bottoms up Agile to a more mid-tier type of thing. I don't think we'll ever go back to tops down, because I think people recognize how bad that is. And frankly, I don't think any executive who's working today could effectively go do that. So that most of us have been steeped in a bottoms up way of working. And we've recognized that tops down planning is actually really, really, really difficult to go do to get right. And because we want to change our minds on a quarterly, you know, half year basis, I believe in a more systematic approach, which involves like what I call like more of a diamond structure, where a set of decisions, but a minority set of decisions, but broader and made up top. And then at the very, very minimal set, like a singular engineer is making, again, singular decisions that affect like that person's output and stuff. But the broad band of majority decisions are made in the middle. And the way you do that is you have to structure your communication and associate prioritization effectively. And I talk about this quite a bit. I talk about mission, vision, goals, priorities, tasks. And if you think about like a kind of a loose structure in that, mission and vision is clearly like, what is the company here for? What is it doing? That's like executive territory. You got to nail that because it leads to the goals and priorities. And the goals are time bounded. You like pick a time frame saying like, we want to achieve X for the business or get Y out for the product or serve this customer in this way for this reason. So you're writing down your goals, giving context, all that. that can be translating into priorities, which become discrete tasks. Now, that is not a top-down approach. That involves like a lot of decision-making, autonomy, and authority in the middle, but you need mature people to go and do that. And you need people who have experience kind of translating from kind of ethereal top-level goal setting to tasks in the middle tier. And I think that's where we're going to end up. That's where I think a lot of mid-tier startups, like I would consider GitHub a mid-tier startup. We're about 2,500 people. We're not 10,000 people, but that's largely how we try to do things. And I think that's where we'll end up, and we'll have some more structure around that.
I think it's really interesting. And I think it definitely opens up us having to do an episode on the Jason Warner diamond. You mentioned something that I, in the context of kind of looking at the 90s to today, I wanted to kind of double click on, which was, say, so, you know, the maturity of people and the maturity of leadership. Engineering leadership till date is still just an almost orally passed on practice. And that's something where I was way too young in the 90s to have seen how it was then. But I feel that that's something where the pendulum hasn't really moved one way or the other in a long time. How do you look at kind of, you know, the development of people from engineer to engineering leader and further on in their career, how that has changed over the last almost 30 years?
I think that there's been an attempt at it a couple of times. You've got books like PeopleWare or Engineering Manager, Management, I think is what it's called. There's a couple of different books that have attempted to do this. But the problem is, who are you talking? What's your audience for this? First-time managers, experienced managers, managers of a 10-person organization, which is very different than managers of a 200-person organization, which is vastly different than manager of a 10,000-person organization. And so the audience is too wide, I think, in those cases. And I think that there's a largely, again, lack of methodology approach to this that's led to it. So good example is like, if you grew up as a salesperson inside Microsoft, you got mentoring along the way because it was so methodical. It's like, this is how you do case review. This is how you do your selling motion. This is how you do your TAM expansion. It was very clear what was going to happen. Now, maybe they couldn't be very malleable and jump into a Google organization, but honestly, you just have to learn Salesforce at that point and you could probably pick it up. I don't know if I see it changing, to be honest with you, in engineering. I think let me say this. We've made the same mistake for 3 decades in engineering leadership, and I still see people trying to make it today, which is, you're the most technical person on the team. I'm going to make you the manager. And I have joked in the past that basically my entire executive career is undoing that decision. You know, when I first joined Canonical, they had no managers for a long time. And then they said, we need managers because everything is on fire. It's all chaos. So therefore, you're the most technical person on the team, you're now the manager. Same thing at Heroku and GitHub, and just have to keep undoing. It's like roll back, roll back, roll back. You know, that mentality, I think, is really what's causing some of the problem. Like I'm a distributed systems engineer, right? So we've talked about this in the past. Yes. My whole thing is distributed systems, but I was always a mediocre developer, but I was really, really, really good at holding the entire system in my head. But in the functions and methods, I was very mediocre to below average. And so it's a very different skill set what it takes to be an executive or a manager than it takes to be the best, most technical engineer on the team. And until we can understand and identify that, then I think that we're going to continue to make those mistakes.
I'm really glad you said this because you touch upon, like you said, it is the most common mistake. And it is something that we make over and over and over again in the world of engineering leadership. If I give you a couple of rules of thumb that I followed throughout my career, I'm very curious to hear your opinion on them. And if they're right, if you think they're right or wrong, or how you look at them. For me, the first most, and I'm talking particularly an early stage company, but I think this will hold true for a very long time, is your engineer, the person you bring as your engineering leader, and particularly if you're picking from a group of people, because in all considerations, most people are not hiring from outside their organization, particularly as they're scaling up, right? They're coming in a room, the team has 7 engineers, and now one person needs to stand up and say, I'm the engineering leader, right? And like you said, usually that's the most technical person. I've always followed the rule of pick the person with the highest empathy. And secondly, and kind of, or it's more a combination, find the strongest system thinker the further up you go into the organization. So empathy plus system thinking, how do you look at this and what might I be missing, or what has been your rules of thumb as you're going through this?
So I think the systems thinking one is the most critical. And I use the same wording and phrasing But I think that if I'm going to look at what I want out of any engineering leader, any leader in general, it's a combination of two sides of the same coin, which I think ends up being what we should talk about as culture at some point. It's what we do and how we do it. So again, culture is not like foosball tables and drinks. It's not even how we communicate to each other exclusively. It's all the expectations and the micro set of things and then the macro things. So expectations and what we do and how we reward and what we recognize and when we say things, but what our expectations are for each other and our accountability and our structures and things of that nature. And I think, you know, there's been a trend in Silicon Valley and software in general to say like culture is all about exclusively the empathy side of things. And I'm glad you said the system thinking, because I think that's needs to be married to each other. What we do and how we do it needs to be married. So when I'm looking for engineering leaders, I look for people who basically have two sets of things. One is people tend to look inside every organization or a team. People tend to look to one person on that team already as saying like, hey, I don't know what to do. Let me go talk to that person. And it's not just technical. It's like, hey, I don't know who to talk to. I don't know what to do. I don't know how to think about this problem. There's usually some person on that team. Could be the tech lead, could be the manager, or if there's no manager, or it could just be a random engineer who's there. But then you have to ask the question of like, are they doing the micro or the macro? And that's where you've got to dig in and figure out, are they thinking about the file and the function, or are they thinking about the system? And if you think about the system, I think they have management potential. Thinking about the file and the function, they have tech lead potential. That's the difference between the two. And usually what I tell people is if you're going to have a manager, particularly a first time, pair them with a tech lead as well. And the tech lead is way more obvious and will be a superpower for that first time manager.
It's super interesting how you kind of call it the two sides of the same coin. You mentioned Silicon Valley trends. And so to bring it back a little bit to the historical viewpoint, what is some of the most destructive trends that you have seen where if you could wave a magic wand and say, I wish that wouldn't have happened in the way that we've developed leadership and organizations, and you'd undo it?
This is a tough one to answer because I think there's quite a bit. I would say one is the expectation that work should be everything to everybody is one trend, I think, in general that we should undo. And I think this is not Silicon Valley or tech. I think it's societal kind of things that are happening, which is institutions have eroded in broader society and things of that nature. So that's one. I think the other is you end up almost in some sort of like religious decamped war between we're going to be the warmest, fuzziest organization to the most brutal, cutthroat organization. Yeah. You're on two sides of a fence and it feels like, and it becomes like this religious connotation. And in fact, like that's both of them did not have their success because of either one of those things. There was it's another complex system where timing and environment are involved as well. And if you don't understand that, and you're going to be picking the wrong thing. And I think what happens is we start picking on each one of those and we start saying like, well, that's the way to do it. And that's the way to do it. And we start parroting, cargo culting, and emulating things. And I think that's incredibly damaging and dangerous, particularly because you're cargo culting from a distance. You weren't in it. You weren't firsthand experiencing it. I think the other is just, obviously this podcast and me talking about stuff is all from a single point of experience. And that can be dangerous for people to listen to me and you talk and then try to reinterpret their situation and context. But I think what's worse is that many people have made a living off of telling other people what to do with very little experience and very, very little nuanced context. It depends type of answers and questions, asking them about their own situation. And I won't point any fingers, but if you're a 2,000 person organization, you should never take advice from a 10 person organization. Like it's very, very different contexts. And if you're a 10 person organization, don't take advice from the 2,000 person organization. You have to understand and filter to your own context.
But I think you touch upon something is that, and there are two different concepts. One is this notion of that we are incredibly mimetic. We are incredibly driven to want to copy what we see as successful. But I think more interesting than that is what you mentioned. We seek for causal relationships when in reality, it's complex systems. Mm-hmm. Where you can't actually say, hey, there is a direct relationship between X, Y, or Z, right? Uber was successful because they were in this way. No, that doesn't mean that it will apply in any other system. Given that people and processes and just engineering organizations in general are such complex systems, if we would start trying to break down this system, you know, what are some of the categories that you think we need to start looking at and some of the relationships that are maybe more easily missed or not as often thought about?
So I think this is going to be an odd one to start with, but I would say venture capital. And the reason why is that I think, so if you've been a part of any number of board meetings with any number of very high regarded, very experienced venture capitalists who are excellent at their jobs, you'll start to see a set of things emerge. And they're not always universal, but there's a set of things. One is, yes, they will talk about the product, but the product is actually less on their list, the lower on their list that they'll talk about. They'll start talking about marketing numbers, sales numbers, and financial numbers. And those are like three number categories where all board meetings kind of degrade into. And they're very valuable things. You have to have those board level conversations. But there is almost no talk about the engineering side of the organization, which for a pre-C series stage company probably makes up 60% of the organization. And the reason why there's no conversation around it is that nobody around the boardroom has any experience in that side of the fence. And I think that that is a challenge when you are this engineering heavy of an industry and people who quote unquote sit around the top table of an organization don't have any experience in it. And Andreessen Horowitz is famed for saying that we will be those people when in fact, they've largely done a better job than the industry, but it's not hard stepping over dead bodies. Yeah. And I think that's one place to start.
It's really interesting you mentioned this because, you know, you started a couple of minutes ago talking about cargo culting and how all of us are trying to fit often a very similar model. It's not just that we it might mean that we lack the engineering leadership or experience at the board meetings. It's that there is very, very little, very few founders or CEOs who are themselves bringing this to the board.
That's right.
Right. And it's engineering, the engineering organization and the state of the engineering organization and the challenges are often not more described than our hiring targets and did we release feature X, Y, or Z. Solving it is not difficult. There's a lot of great engineering leaders out there like yourself and others that can be put on boards of companies. What do you think is inhibiting it? What is stopping this from happening?
I think that there's inertia. I think that there's some industry trends that need to fully play out and maybe they'll go a different way. If you look at largely who has become CEOs of organizations over the last 20 years, marketing, sales, finance, and some product people, but no one who has run very large organizations inside of Google, Microsoft has actually graduated up to become the CEO. Now you could say like maybe Satya, but he was the product person paired with an engineering leader. And a lot of those organizations actually don't allow people to join boards. So example, Salesforce has a policy that you can't join a board if you're a Salesforce executive, if you're not on the ultimate e-staff. And I think there's only three exceptions in the entire company. I also think that boards themselves are always looking for other people besides engineering. I still think boards a lot of times think that engineering just needs to go and do it. They just need to figure it out. They just need to execute. And you can hear the saying, I'm sure you've heard this in your voice, like now all they need to do is execute. Now all the football team needs to do is actually play the game and win it, which is really, isn't that what it's all about actually?
Yeah.
So, you know, it'd be the same thing I think as like football coaches or basketball coaches or whatever, sitting around all day and pontificating and none of them having experience actually being on the field. That would be a tragedy because they want to know what it's like out there. I don't know. I think that, you know, as trends go, we should get more engineering leaders on boards. I do think that us engineering leaders don't do ourselves any favors in this capacity too, because we just want to keep building. And sometimes building, I think we can flip it around and say company building. And this is actually a change that I've made in the last, you know, 5-7 years or so, is saying like my product is going to become the company. And I want to show that an engineering leader, it can be thought of in the same capacity as all the other ones in the industry. And it's interesting because, you know, if I still get calls for recruiting, they're always for VP of engineering or CTOs. And I said, my next step, if I go to anything operational, it will always be CEO. And every recruiter says CTOs can't make the jump to CEO. You just can't do it. No one's going to take a bet on a CTO to jump to CEO. And that is a tragedy in my opinion, tragedy.
And it's especially a tragedy because at the end of the day, building a company is building a distributed system.
It is.
Right.
And a more complex version of it and the best suited person to build that.
Absolutely. And so you mentioned, you know, when we spoke about, you know, engineering leadership developing, you listed off a couple of the books that we all know, and there's two or three others, but there really is about 5-6 books that every engineering leader knows, and that's it.
That's it.
And that's it, right? And some of those books have been around for over a decade already.
Another way to frame this, sorry, not to cut you off.
No, go ahead.
Because I mean, you know, I'm friendly with almost all the big VC firms in the Valley, and not even the books, but there's the same 10 or 15 CTOs that get calls about mentoring all the other CEOs, startup CEOs or CTOs. And it's the dirty little secret of the industry is no one actually knows how to do this. And there's just a very small handful of people that have gone from like the garage to the 5,000 people and be able to have that conversation. And I just think until we start like, you know, methodically writing it down I say that and I know I'm not doing it right now either because I've got other things I'm trying to achieve as opposed to writing that down. So I'm not sure what's going to take to break it.
So I think that's a really good note to end it on because the whole purpose of this podcast that we're doing together is to not have to have you write it down, Jason, but to see if we can get you to say it and to kind of explore these topics. I really enjoyed today. I think we started on a lot of different aspects that we're going to have to elaborate on, but we'll have plenty of time to do so.
Awesome. It was fun. Thanks for having me.